Verna was suddenly in a panic. Her eyes were tearing. She threw her arms around him.
Warren, I'll stay.
I won't go. I'll help you.
We'll do something. Maybe we could take a collar off one of the boys and you could share it. That might work. We'll try that first.
His arms pulled her tight.
That won't work, Verna.
A sudden thought flashed into her mind, making her gasp with relief. It was so simple.
Warren, it's all right, it is. I just realized what we can do. Listen to me.
Verna, I know what... She shushed him. She held him by the shoulders and looked into his blue eyes. She brushed back his wavy blonde hair.
Warren, listen. It's simple. The reason the sisters were founded was to help boys born with the gift. We were given Radha Han to protect them while we teach them to control their gift.
Verna, I know all that, but
listen. We have the collars to help them because we don't have wizards who can do what is needed. In the past, greedy wizards refused to help those born with the gift. An experienced wizard can join with your mind and pass on the protection, show you how to put the gift right. It's simple for a wizard to do, but not a sorceress. We need only to visit a wizard.
Verna pried the journey book from her belt and held it before his eyes.
We have a wizard. Zed! All we have to do is talk to Anne and have her and Zed meet us. Zed can help you, and then you'll be all right.
Warren stared into her eyes.
Verna, it won't work. Don't say that. You don't know. You don't know, Warren.
Yes, I do. I have had another prophecy. Verna sat back on her heels.
You have? What was it?
Warren pressed his fingertips to his temples. She could see that he was in pain. She knew that the pain of the headaches from the gift were excruciating. In the end, if not corrected, they were fatal.
Verna, now you listen to me for a change. I have had a prophecy. The words aren't important, the meaning is.
He took his hands away from his head and looked her in the eye. In that moment, he looked very old to her.
You must do what you plan and go after the sisters. The prophecy didn't say whether you will succeed, but I must go with you. If I do anything else, I will die. It's a forked prophecy, an either-or prophecy.
She cleared her throat.
But surely there must be something.
No. If I stay or if I try to go to Zed, I will die. The prophecy doesn't say that if I go with you I will live, but it does say that going with you is my only chance.
End of discussion. If you make me stay, I will die. If you try to take me to Zed, I will die. If you want me to have a chance to live, then you must take me with you. Choose, prelate.
Verna swallowed. As a sister of the light, a sorceress, she could tell by the distinctive murky cast to his eyes that he was in the pain of a headache from the gift. She also knew that Warren would not lie to her about a prophecy. He might pull some trick to go with her, but he would not lie about a prophecy. He was a prophet. Prophecy was his life. Maybe his death. She took his hand up in hers.
Get some supplies together. Get two horses. I have to go tell 80 something, and then I must talk to my advisors. Let them know what to do while we're gone.
Verna kissed his hand.
I won't let you die, Warren. I love you too much. We'll do this together. I'm not sleepy. Let's not wait till morning. We can be on our way in an hour.
Warren drew her to him in a thankful embrace. Chapter 24. From the solace of the shadows, he watched as the middle-aged man closed the door and stood in the dim hall a moment to tuck in his shirt over his pot belly. The man chortled to himself, and then thumped off down the hall to disappear as he descended the stairs. It was late. It would be several hours yet before the sun was up. With the walls painted red, the candles set before silvered reflectors at either end of the narrow hall were able to provide precious little useful light. He liked it that way, the way the comforting cloak of shadows in the pit of the night lent its mood to such nefarious needs. Debauchery was best indulged in the night, in the darkness. He stood a while in the quiet obscurity of the hall, savoring his desire. It had been too long. He let his lust have rein and felt its glorious, wanton ache fill him. He closed his mouth and breathed through his nose, to better experience the range of aromas, both transcendent and abiding. He put his shoulders back and used his abdominal muscles to draw slower,
deeper breaths. He counted a variety of scents, from the smells men carried in and took away with them back to their own lives, the smells of their work, horse, clay, grain dust, the lanolin soldiers used in the care of leather uniforms, and the oil they used for sharpening their weapons, to a redolent wisp of almond oil, and the stale dirt and wet wood of the building. It was an afferent feast that was only just beginning. He glanced the length of the hall again, checking. He heard no sounds of lust coming from any of the other rooms. It was late, even for an establishment like this. The fat, pot-bellied man was probably the last of them, except for himself. He liked to be last. The evidence of the events before he arrived and the lingering smells gave him a rush of sensation. His senses were always heightened in his aroused state, and he valued all the details. He closed his eyes for a moment, feeling the throbbing of his need. She would help him. She would sate his desire. That was what they were here for. They offered themselves willingly. Other men, like the pot-bellied man, simply threw themselves on a woman, grunted in a moment of satisfaction, and it was over. They never gave thought to what the woman was feeling, to what she needed, to giving her satisfaction. Those men were no more than rutting beasts, ignorant of all the details that could add to the climax for both. Their mind's eye was too focused on the object of their lust. They didn't see the integral parts of the wider setting that led to true satisfaction. It was the fleeting, the ephemeral that created a transcendent experience. Through uncommon perception and his singular awareness, he could net such evanescent events and commemorate them forever in his memory, thus giving the transient nature of satisfaction permanence. He felt fortunate that he could see such things and that he, at least, could bring fulfillment to women. At last, he took a settling breath and then advanced silently down the hall, marking the way the shadows and tiny rays of light mirrored off the silvered candle reflectors slipped across his body. He thought that if he was mindful, he might someday be able to feel the touch of the light and of the dark. Without knocking, he opened the door the pot-bellied man had come from and stepped into her room, gratified to see that it was nearly as dim as the hall. With a finger, he shut the door. Behind the door, the woman was just pulling her panties up her legs. She spread her knees and squatted a bit, drawing them up tight against herself. When her sky-blue eyes finally turned up to look at him, her only reaction was to toss the sides of her robe together over the rest of her bare body and casually flip the silk belt together into a loose knot. The air carried the odor of the hot coals in the warming pan under the bed, the weak but clean aroma of soap, the light fragrance of body powder, and the cloying scent of a sickly sweet perfume. But pervading it all, like the darkness that shaped shadows, was the lingering smack of lust, pointed with the arresting scent of semen. The room had no windows. The bed, covered with stained, rumpled sheets, was pushed into the far corner. Even though it wasn't large, the bed took up a good part of the room. Against the wall, beside the head of the bed, sat a small, simply made pine chest, probably for personal items. On the wall over the head of the bed hung an ink drawing of two people coupled in passion. It left nothing to the imagination. A wash basin sat centered on a wobbly-looking cabinet beside her, behind the door. In its edge, the white wash basin had a stained, kidney-shaped chip with a crack that looked like an artery coming from the kidney. The cloth hanging over the side of the basin still dripped. The milky water in the basin gently sloshed from side to side. She had just washed herself. They each had their own habits. Some didn't bother to wash, but they were usually the older, unattractive ones who were paid little and cared little. He had noticed that the younger, prettier, more expensive women washed after each man. He preferred the ones who washed before he came to them, but in the end his lust overrode such trivial matters. He idly wondered if those he had been with who were not professionals, ever gave thought to such things. Probably not. He doubted that others pondered such curious particulars. Others gave little thought to the texture of details. Other women, women looking for love, satisfied him, but not in the same way. They always wanted to talk and to be wooed. They wanted. He wanted. In the end, his want overrode what he would prefer, and he gave them some of what they wanted before his needs could be satisfied.
"I thought I was finished for the night," she said.
Her words came out silky smooth with a pleasant, hurt lilt, but bore no real interest at the prospect of another man this late.
"I think I'm the last," he said, trying to sound apologetic so as not to anger her.
It wasn't as satisfying if they were angry. He liked nothing more than when they were eager to please. She sighed.
"All right, then."
She showed no fear at having a man simply walk into her room without knocking, even though she was hardly wearing anything, nor did she make any demands for money. Silas Latherton, downstairs with his cudgel and a long knife in his belt, made sure the women had nothing to fear. He also didn't let anyone go up the stairs unless they paid in advance, so the women didn't have to be bothered with the trouble of collecting money. It ensured that he, rather than they, kept control of the income and its distribution. Her short, straight blonde hair was disheveled, from Mr. Potbelly, no doubt, but he found its disorder alluring. It was a suggestive indication of what she had just been doing. It lent her an erotic look, a look he very much liked. Her body was shapely and firm, with long legs and wonderfully formed breasts, at least what he had seen of her body before she had thrown closed her robe. He would see it again, and could wait. The anticipation added to his excitement. Unlike her other men, he was in no rush to have it over. Once it began, it would be over all too quickly. He could never stop himself once it began. For the moment, he would relish all the little details so that he could capture them in his memory for all time. She was more than simply pretty, he decided. She was a creature possessed of features that would fire men's minds with obsessive memories of her and make them return time and time again to try, if only for fleeting moments, to possess her. The confidence with which she carried her body told him that she knew this. The frequency with which men spent money to have her was a constant reinforcement of that confidence. Those features, though, no matter their grace and haunting beauty, had an acidic edge to them, a harshness that betrayed her true character. No doubt other men saw only the sweet face and never noticed. He noticed. He noticed such subtle things, and he had seen this detail often. It always looked the same. It was a baseness her fair features couldn't hide from one such as himself.
"Are you new?" he asked, even though he knew she was.
"First day here," she said.
He knew that, too.
"Aiden Drill is big enough to mean clients for me, but with a huge army here it's all the better. Blue eyes around here aren't all that common. My blue eyes remind the Daharan soldiers of girls from home. So many extra men mean women like me are in greater demand."
"And it ensures a better wage." She allowed herself a small, smug, knowing smile.
"If you couldn't afford it, you wouldn't be up here, so cut the complaints."
He had only meant to make an observation, and regretted the way she took it. Her voice betrayed an underlying, acerbic temperament. He sought to smooth away the ripple of her displeasure with him. "Soldiers can sometimes get rough with a young woman as attractive as you." The compliment didn't register in her sky-blue eyes. She had probably heard it so often that she was numb to such praise. "I'm glad you came to Silas Latherton," he went on. "He doesn't let any of his clients rough up the young ladies. You'll be safe here, under his roof. I'm glad you came here."
"Thanks."
Her tone carried no warmth, but the ripple, at least, had been smoothed.
"I'm glad to hear his reputation is known to his clients. I got slammed around, once. I didn't like it. Besides the pain, I couldn't work for a month."
"That must have been terrible." The pain, I mean. She tilted her head toward the bed.
You going to take off your clothes or what?
He said nothing but gestured to her robe. He watched her slip loose the knot from the satin belt.
Have it your way,
she said, as she shrugged the robe open just enough to tempt him into getting on with it.
I'd like you to enjoy it, too.
She lifted an eyebrow.
Darling, don't you worry about me. I'll enjoy it just fine. You'll no doubt thrill me, but you're the one who's paid for it. Let's just worry about your pleasure.
He liked to hear the tempered thread of sarcasm in her voice. She cloaked it well with a breathy tone, and others might have missed it, but he had been listening for it. Carefully, slowly, one at a time, he placed four small gold coins on the washstand beside her. It was 10 times what Silas Lafferton downstairs charged for his women's company, and probably 30 times what he gave her for each man. She watched the coins as he withdrew his hand, as if counting them to herself to make sure she was seeing what she thought she was seeing. It was a great deal of money. She gave him a questioning look. He liked the twitch of confusion in her eyes. Women like this weren't often confused by money. But she was young, and probably never had a man bestow such largesse on her before. He liked it, that it impressed her. He knew that few things would.
I'd like you to enjoy yourself. I'm willing to pay to see you enjoying yourself. Darling, for that much, you'll remember my screams until you're an old man.
Of that he was sure. She smiled her best smile and slipped off the robe. Gazing at him with her big, sky-blue eyes, she blindly hung the robe on a peg in the back of the door. She stroked his chest and then circled her arms around his waist. Gently, but deliberately, she squashed her firm breasts against him.
So what is it you want, darling? Some nice claw marks down your back to make your young lady jealous?
No, he said. No, I just want to see you enjoying it. You're so fair of face and figure. I think that if you're paid well enough, you'll enjoy your part, that's all. I want to know that you're enjoying yourself. She eyed the coins and then smiled up at him.
Oh, I will, darling. I promise. I'm a very talented whore.
That was what I was hoping.
I want you to be so pleased with my charms that you will want to return to my bed.
You seem to be reading my mind.
My name is Rose,
she breathed in her breathy voice. A name as beautiful as you are, and as unoriginal.
And yours? What should I call you when you call on me regularly, as I'm already aching for you to do?
I like the name you've already given me. I like the sound of it on your lips. She licked her lips for him.
Glad to meet you, darling.
He slipped a finger under the waist of her panties. Can I have these? She ran her fingers down his belly, performing a moan at the feel of him.
It's the end of a long day. These aren't exactly clean. I have some clean ones in my trunk. For what you've paid, you can have as many of them as you wish. Darling, you can have all of them, if you wish.
These will do fine. I only need these. She smirked up at him.
I see. Like that, is it?
He didn't answer.
Why don't you take them off me?
She teased.
Take your prize.
I'd like to watch you do it. Without hesitation, she slipped them down her legs as dramatically as she could. She pressed herself up against him again and, looking into his eyes, stroked his cheek with her panties. She smiled wickedly and then pushed them into his hand.
Here you go. Just for you, darling. Just the way you like them. With the scent of rose.
He worked them in his fingers, feeling the warmth of her still in them. She stretched up to kiss him. If he hadn't known better, known what she was, he might have thought she wanted him more than anything else in life. But he would please her.
What do you want me to do for you?
She whispered.
Name it, and it's yours. And I don't make that offer to my other men. But I want you so badly. Anything. Just tell me.
He could smell the sweat of the other men on her. He could smell the stink of their lust on her.
Let's just see how things work out, shall we, Rose?
Anything you say, darling.
She smiled dreamily.
Anything.
She winked at him as she swept the 4 gold coins from the washstand. She swayed provocatively as she went to the small trunk. She squatted down before it. He had been wondering if she would squat or bend at the waist. He was satisfied at the detail, at the remnant of a demure past. As she pushed the coins under some of her clothes in the chest, he saw, atop her things, a small pillow decorated with a dash of red. Such a detail intrigued him. It seemed out of place.
"What's that?" he asked, knowing that the money had earned her indulgence.
She held it up for him to see. It was a small pillow, an item of decoration, of frivolity. It had a red rose embroidered on it.
"I made it when I was younger. I stuffed it with cedar shavings so it would smell nice."
She glided her fingers lovingly over the rose.
"My namesake. A rose. For Rosa. My father named me. He was from Nicobris. Rosa means rose in his language. He always called me his little Rosa and said that I grew in the garden of his heart."
The detail astonished him. He was thrilled to know something so intimate about her. He felt as if he already possessed her. The pleasure of knowing such a small, seemingly insignificant thing pounded through his veins. As he watched her replace the little packet of her past into her trunk, he wondered at her father, wondered if he knew where she was, or if perhaps he had sent her away in revulsion, his rose wilted in his heart. He imagined an angry scene. He wondered at her mother, if her mother understood her choice in life, or cried at a daughter lost. Now he, too, was playing a part in who she was, in her life.
"May I call you Rosa?"
he asked, as she closed the lid of her trunk.
"It's such a lovely name."
She looked back over her shoulder. Her eyes watched his fingers working her underpants into a tight ball. She returned to him, smiling as she came.
"You're my special man now. I've never told another man my true name. It would give me pleasure to hear my given name on your lips."
His heart pounded, and he swayed on his feet with his need.
"Thank you, Rosa,"
he whispered, and he truly meant it.
"I want so much to please you."
"Your hands are trembling."
They always did, until he started. Then they were rock steady. Once he started, he would be steady. It was just the anticipation. "I'm sorry."
A throaty, lusty laugh came from deep in her throat.
"Don't be. It excites me that you would be nervous."
He wasn't nervous, not in the least, but he was excited. Her hands found that he was.
"I want to taste you."
She licked his ear.
"I have no one else tonight. We have all the time we want to enjoy this."
"I know," he whispered back. "That's why I wanted to be last."
"Yes,"
she teased.
"I want it to last, too. Can you make it last, darling?"
"I can and I will," he promised. "A long time."
She let out a purr of satisfaction at his promise and turned in his arms, pressing her bottom against him. She arched her back and rocked her head against his chest as she moaned again. He kept the smirk from his face as he looked down into her sky-blue eyes.
Yes, she was a talented whore.
He slid his hand down her lower spine, counting her vertebrae, fingering the spaces between them. She moaned urgently at his touch. Because of the way she swayed her bottom, he missed the spot he wanted. She staggered. The second time he slammed the knife into her lower back, he hit the right spot, between the vertebrae, severing her spinal cord. He swept an arm around her middle to hold her up. The shocked, grunting moan was real this time. Anyone in the other rooms wouldn't think it any different from the sounds she regularly made for men. Others didn't notice such details. He did, and savored the difference. As her mouth widened to scream, he stuffed it full with the wadded ball of her dirty panties. He timed it just right, so only the cry of the gasp sounded before the pitch rose. He yanked the silk tie from her robe on the peg beside him and whirled it around her head four times to hold the gag in her mouth. With one hand and the aid of his teeth, he drew it tight and knotted it. He would have liked to have listened to her heartfelt screams, but that would bring a premature end to their pleasure. He loved the screams, the cries. They were always sincere. He pressed his mouth against the side of her head. He could smell the sweat of men in her hair. "Oh, Rosa, you are going to please me so. You are going to give me more pleasure than you've ever given any man before. I want you to enjoy it, too. I know this is what you always wanted. I'm the man you've been waiting for. I've come at last." He let her slip to the floor. Her legs were useless now. She wasn't going anywhere. She tried to punch him between his legs. He caught her dainty little fist in his hand. He watched her wide, sky-blue eyes as he pressed open her fist. He held her palm between his thumb and a finger and bent it down until the bones in her wrist snapped. He used the arms of her robe to bind her hands so that she couldn't pull the gag from her mouth. His heart hammered as he listened to her muffled wails. He couldn't understand the words against the gag, but they heightened his excitement because he could feel their pain. A storm of emotion rampaged through his mind. At least the voices were silent for now, leaving him to his lust. He wasn't sure what the voices were, but he was sure that he was only able to hear them because of his singular intellect. He was able to seine such evanescent messages from the ethers because of his incomparable perception, and because he minded the details. Tears flooded down her face, her perfectly plucked brows bunched together, lifting in the middle, furrowing the skin on her forehead into neat rows. He counted them, because he was special. With wide, anguished, sky-blue eyes, she watched as he removed his clothes and set them aside. It wouldn't do to have them soaked in blood. The knife was rock steady in his hand now. He stood above her, naked and erect, to show her what a good job she was doing for him so far. And then he began. Chapter 25. Colin, with Kara following behind, came to the door of the small room Richard used as an office at the same time as a young woman with short black hair arrived, carrying a small silver tray with hot tea. Raina, standing guard beside the door along with Ulick and Egan, yawned.
"Richard asked for tea, Sarah?"
The young woman curtsied as best she could, holding the tray.
"Yes, Mother Confessor."
Colin lifted the tray from the woman's hands.
"That's all right, Sarah. I'm going in. I'll take it in to him."
Sarah blushed, trying to hold on to the tray.
"But, Mother Confessor, you shouldn't have to do that."
"Don't be silly. I'm perfectly capable of carrying a tray for 10 feet.
Colin backed away a step, gaining full possession of the tray. Sarah didn't know what to do with her hands, so she bowed.
"Yes, Mother Confessor," she said before departing.
Rather than being pleased to have been relieved of a small task, she looked as if she had just been ambushed and robbed. Sarah, like most of the staff, was fiercely vigilant about her duties.
"Has he been up long?"
Colin asked Raina. Raina gave her a sullen look.
"Yes, all night. I finally left a squad of guards and went to bed. He had Badine up with him all night, too."
The reason, no doubt, for the sullen look.
"I'm sure it was important, but I'll see if I can't get him to stop at night for some sleep, or at least let Badine get hers."
"I would appreciate it," Kara muttered. "Raina gets grumpy when Badine doesn't come to bed."
"Badine needs her sleep,"
Raina said defensively.
"I'm sure it was important, Raina, but you're right. If people don't get enough sleep, they won't be any good to him. I'll remind him. He sometimes gets lost in what he's doing and forgets about what other people need."
Raina's dark eyes brightened.
"Thank you, Mother Confessor."
Colin balanced the tray in one hand as she opened the door. Kara took up station beside Raina, peering after Colin to make sure she didn't have any trouble with the tray, and then closed the door. Richard had his back to her as he stared out the window. A low fire in the hearth did a poor job banishing the chill from the room. Colin smirked to herself. She would put the lie to his boast. Before she had a chance to set the tray on the table and let the cup ping against the pot to catch his attention and make him think it was the serving woman, Richard spoke without turning.
Colin, good, I'm glad you came.
Frowning, she set down the tray.
You have your back to the door. How could you know it was me and not the woman bringing the tea you ordered?
Richard turned around with a puzzled look.
Why would I think it was the woman with the tea when it was you bringing it in?
He truly looked bewildered by her question.
I swear, Richard, sometimes you give me the shivers.
She decided that he had to have seen her reflection in the window. He lifted her chin with a finger and kissed her.
I'm glad to see you. It's been lonely without you.
Sleep well?
Sleep? I guess not. But at least the riots seem to have ceased. I don't know what we would have done if the moon had risen red again. I can't believe people would go wild simply because of something like that.
You have to admit that it was odd. Frightening.
I do. But that didn't make me want to run screaming through the streets, breaking windows and setting fires.
That's because you're Lord Rawl and you have more sense.
I'll have some order, too. I'll not have people doing that kind of damage, to say nothing of injuring innocent people. The next time it happens, I'm going to have the soldiers put it down immediately, rather than wait, hoping people will be suddenly stricken with reason. I have more important matters to worry about than childish reactions to superstition.
Colin could tell by his smoldering tone that he was on the verge of losing his temper. His eyes were bleary. She knew that if a person didn't get enough sleep, forbearance would quickly evaporate. One night was one thing, but three in a row was quite another. She hoped it wasn't affecting his judgment.
More important matters? You mean your work with Berdine?
He nodded. Colin poured a cup of tea and held it out to him. He stared at the cup a moment before taking it.
Richard, you have to let the poor woman get more sleep. She'll be no good to you if you don't let her have enough sleep.
He took a sip.
I know.
He turned to the window and yawned.
I had to send her over to my room to take a nap. She was making mistakes.
Richard, you need to get some sleep, too.
He stared out the window toward the massive stone walls of the Wizard's Keep up on the mountain.
I think I may have found out what the red moon meant.
The somber quality in his voice gave her pause.
What?
She finally asked. He turned to the table and set down the cup. I had Berdine looking for places where Kolo used the word moss, or maybe mentioned a red moon, hoping that we might find something to help us. He flipped open the journal on the table. He had found the journal up in the keep, where it had been sealed in for 3,000 years, along with the man who had written it. Kolo had been keeping watch over the Slif, the strange creature that could take some people great distances when the towers separating the old and new worlds were completed. When the towers were activated, Kolo had been sealed in, trapped, and had died there. The journal had already proven an invaluable source of information, but it was written in High Dharan, which complicated matters. Berdine understood High Dharan, but not such an ancient form of it. They had to use another book written in almost the same ancient form of High Dharan to aid them. Richard's childhood memory of that book's story helped Berdine to translate words, which they used as a cross-reference in order to work out the translation of the journal. As they went along, Richard was learning much of both the vernacular High Dharan and also the much older Argo form, but it was still frustratingly slow going. After Richard had brought Colin back to Adendril, he told her how he had used the information in the book to find a way to rescue her. He said that sometimes he could seem to read with ease, but then at other places he and Berdine became bogged down. He said that at times he was able to unravel a page in a few hours, and then they would spend a whole day trying to translate one sentence.
Moss. You said you had her checking for the word moss. What's that mean?
He took a sip of tea and set the cup back down.
Moss?
It means wind in High Dharan. He opened the pages to a marker. Since it was taking so much time to translate the journal, we've just been looking for key words and then concentrating on those passages, hoping to get lucky.
I thought you said that you were translating it in order, to better understand the way Kolo uses the language.
He sighed in annoyance.
Colin, I don't have time for that. We had to change our tactics.
Colin didn't like the sound of that.
Richard, I was told that your brother is the high priest of an order called the Rochmos. Is that High Daharan?
Means divine wind, he muttered.
He tapped the book, not seeming to want to discuss it.
See here? Radin found where Kolo was talking about a red moon. He was really upset about it. The whole keep was in an uproar. He writes that they were betrayed by the team. He said that the team was to be put on trial for their crimes. We haven't had time to look into that yet, but...
Richard flipped the book back toward the front, where one of their written translations was inserted, and read her the passage.
Today, one of our most coveted desires, possible only through the brilliant, tireless work of a team of near to 100, has been accomplished. The items most feared lost, should we be overrun, have been protected. A cheer went up from all in the keep when we received word today that we were successful. Some thought it was not possible, but to the astonishment of all, it is done. The Temple of the Winds is gone.
Gone? Colin asked. What's the Temple of the Winds? Where did it go?
Richard shut the book.
I don't know. But later in the journal, Kolo says that this team who had done it had betrayed them all. High Daharan is an odd language. Words have different meanings depending on how they're used.
Most languages are that way. Our own is.
Yes, but sometimes, in High Daharan, a word that ordinarily has different meanings according to its usage is intended to have multiple meanings. You can't have one meaning without all the rest. That makes translating it all the more difficult. For example, in the old prophecy that names me the bringer of death, the word death means three different things, depending on how it's used. The bringer of the underworld, the world of the dead, the bringer of spirits, spirits of the dead, and the bringer of death, meaning to kill. Each meaning is different, but all three were intended. That was the key. The prophecy was in the book we brought with us from the Palace of the Prophets. Warren was only able to translate the prophecy after I told him that all three meanings were true. He told me that because of that, he was the first in thousands of years to know the true meaning of the prophecy as it was written.
What does this have to do with the Temple of the Winds?
When Kolo says winds, I think that he sometimes just means the wind, like when you say that the wind is blowing today. But sometimes when he says winds, I think he means the Temple of the Winds. I think he used it as a short way of referring to the Temple of the Winds, and at the same time as a way to differentiate it from other temples.
Colin blinked. Are you saying that you think Shota's message, that the wind hunts you, means that the Temple of the Winds is really somehow hunting you?
I don't know, for sure.
Richard, that's a pretty big leap of reasoning, if that's what you're really thinking, to take Kolo's short way of referring to the Temple of the Winds and infer that Shota is talking about the same place?
When Kolo talks about how everyone was in an uproar, and these men were to be put on trial, he makes it sound as if the winds have a sense of perception.
Colin cleared her throat this time.
Richard, are you trying to tell me that Kolo claims that this place, the Temple of the Winds, is sentient?
She wondered how long it had been since he had gotten any sleep. She wondered if he was thinking clearly.
I said I wasn't sure.
But that's what you mean.
Well, it sounds... absurd when you say it like that. It doesn't sound the same when you read it in High Daharan. I don't know how to explain the difference, but there is one. Maybe it's just a difference of degree.
Difference of degree or not, how can a place have a sense of perception, be sentient?
Richard sighed.
I don't know. I've been trying to figure that out myself. Why do you think I've been up all night?
But such a thing is not possible.
His defiant gray eyes turned to her.
The wizard's keep is just a place, but it knows when someone violates it. It reacts to that violation by stopping the person, even killing them if it must, to prevent an unauthorized person from entering a place they don't belong.
Colin made a face.
Richard, that's the shields. Wizards place those shields to protect important or dangerous things from being stolen, or to prevent people from going where they could be hurt.
But they react without anyone having to tell them to, don't they?
So does a leg-hold trap. That doesn't make them sentient. You mean that the Temple of the Winds is protected by shields? That's all you're saying, then, that it has shields?
Yes and no.
It's more than simply shields. Shields only ward.
The way Kolo talks about it makes it sound like the Temple of the Winds can... I don't know, like it can think. Like it can decide things when it must.
Decide things? Like what?
When he wrote how everyone was in a panic about the Red Moon, that was when he said that the team who had sent the Temple of the Winds away had betrayed them.
So... what?
So I think that the Temple of the Winds made the moon turn red.
Colin watched his eyes, transfixed by the look of conviction in them. I won't even ask how such a thing would be possible, but for the moment let's just say you're right. Why would the Temple of the Winds make the moon turn red?
Richard held her gaze. As a warning.
Of what?
The shields in the keep react by warding. Almost no one can pass through them. I can, because I have the right kind of magic. If someone who wants to do harm has enough magic and knowledge, they too can get by the shields. What happens then?
Well, nothing. They get through.
Exactly. I think the Temple of the Winds can do more. I think it can know if someone has violated its defenses and send a warning.
The Red Moon, she whispered.
It makes sense.
She put a hand tenderly to his arm.
Richard, you need to get some rest. You can't infer all this from Kolo's journal alone. It was just one journal, written a long time ago.
This is the end of Side 2. You should now...